Welcome to the Special Sauce Podcast, real conversations about food and life, hosted by Serious Eats founder, Ed Levine.
It's been an incredible journey that is actually making people think about the food of African Americans and the incredible amount of input the African American hand has had, if you will, in the American cooking pot.
On this episode of Special Sauce, we catch up with writer Jessica Harris. Her book, High on the Hog, A Culinary Journey from Africa to America, was turned into a critically acclaimed Netflix series. And celebrity chef Marcus Samuelson weighs in on the importance of Harris's work. It's all coming up on Special Sauce. We are catching up with the incredible Jessica Harris, who last graced our presence, actually in person, on Martha's Vineyard, right? It was crazy.
Absolutely. We went to my friend's studio and actually looked at each other.
Right, and it was like 6 blocks from your house.
Indeed.
It aired last February, and obviously the most obvious thing that has happened since then is that High on the Hog, which has been adapted from your amazing book, was made into a hit Netflix series. Tell us about that, your involvement, and how did it make you feel? Let's start there.
I guess the thing to say is that my life has completely kind of spun around and changed. I was being kind of quiet, enjoying retirement, working and doing all sorts of things, working on a book and, you know, doing some articles. And then all of a sudden, it's like, yikes. So interesting things are happening. Good things are happening. I'm working on a couple of projects with folks. I am consulting with the New York Botanical Garden, which is great. I am doing some stuff with the Martha's Vineyard Museum. We're going to hopefully do a food symposium in 23, which will be fun. It'll be part of their, I think it's their 100th anniversary. And a book that was supposed to get finished didn't, so I will be working on that.
It's a good thing that you're very close friends with your editor, or else you'd be in serious trouble.
Oh, I am in serious trouble, but I think my editor understands, and publishers are kind of happy that more people know my name than did before.
And it's fascinating, and we should say your editor is Francis Lamb, who is also the host of Splendid Table. But here's the thing that I keep thinking about, Jessica, when I think about High on the Hog. You've been doing amazing work for probably 50 years. And I'm not exaggerating, everybody.
I'm old. What can I say?
When they adapted High on the Hog, did you feel vindicated or just thrilled that it was being done?
I don't know. I think the thing that I felt most was just astonished. I'm delighted that it was done. I look forward to the second season because there's going to be a second season. Netflix has already announced that. I don't know about vindicated because I wasn't thinking about vindication. I do what I do because I can't do anything else. So I wasn't really looking for that aspect of it. But what is interesting and good is that it's just really kind of been an incredible journey that is actually making people think in other ways about the food of African Americans and African Americans and food, and the incredible amount of input that the African American hand has had, if you will, in the American cooking pot. One of the things that I didn't talk about earlier is a show for the Museum of Food and Drink, which is called African/American, Making the Nation's Table. And that's going to open at the Africa Center in New York City on the 15th of February.
Man, it's raining Jessica Harris out there.
Yeah, you can't get rid of me. You can't swing a dead cat and not hit something me.
And how did you feel? Obviously, adaptations are by definition not exclusively based on the original source material. How did you feel about the adaptation?
I am pleased with it. I have said before, and I think this is the analogy I'm going to stick with. It's sort of like having, I would imagine, I am not a parent, but having a child that is adopted. You know, you mm-hmm. give your child up for adoption, and then you meet your child again when it is an adult. Mm-hmm. I recognize that it is my child. I recognize equally that it may not be the way I might have raised my child, but it is my child. So, I mean, I right. think that that's what it is. It is a very successful adoption.
Yeah. Were they solicitous and gracious in asking for your input?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, there's been no friction of any sort one way or the other. We have gotten along well. I have had some input, not a holding hand kind of process. It is really the work of One Story Up and Karis Jagger and Fabian Toback. But I've been responsible for a few things. For example, I suggested that they go to Benin to film the first episode. So that I can claim and will claim total credit for. There are several people that appear that I know I suggested. But they did very much do their due diligence, and it is theirs every bit as much as it is mine.
Yeah. I mean, I think the great thing is you spent your whole life doing this work, your whole work life, or most of it. And to see it touch so many people's lives and to really change people's perception of the food of the African diaspora must give you an enormous amount of satisfaction.
It does. But, you know, the bottom line is I don't really even think about it. You know, I don't wake up and go, oh, wow, look at that. Isn't that wonderful? You know, it's like, no, I don't, you know, it is, you know, keep moving, face forward, get it done. Lots of other things I want to do. Keep moving.
I guess that's kind of been your philosophy, either that you had to adopt or wanted to adopt a long time ago.
I have a lot of friends who are in their 40s and 50s, which is friends who basically are young enough to potentially be my children. But I realize that their generation is very intentional. They sort of set intentions and then work toward them. I think that my/our generation was less so. I certainly didn't set intention. I went to college. That was my parents' intention. I, you know, graduated, went to grad school. After the master's, got a job and stayed in it. I mean, yeah. We talk about all of this stuff as though writing and pursuing food things were what I have done. But no, I spent my career teaching. I spent 50 years, that's 50, teaching at Queens College, CUNY in New York City. And so that's the career. The food basically was the hobby.
It was a side dish.
Okay, it was a side dish. It was a side dish, but it was the compelling side dish. It was a side dish that became the avocation that now that I have retired from teaching is becoming the main dish. So that's part of the transition and the change as well.
Yeah. And of course, it's kind of neat the way the two things dovetailed, right? Because the series is teaching people not all of what you've taught in your many, many years of teaching.
Mm-mm, don't get it twisted now. My teaching was basically remedial English. So I am not teaching anything related to food. I have done that on a couple of occasions, not that many. But when I started teaching, first and foremost, food history and all of the things that people are doing and teaching about food now didn't even exist as disciplines. So it was something completely and totally different. I started out teaching French. I taught French grammar and composition and moved from teaching French into teaching English because I'd had, again, that sort of parallel career, that avocation, that thing that I did because I couldn't not do it. Of writing. And so there's all of that. Yeah. But the teaching was never teaching food or food history or food culture or anything like that. It was teaching English. English composition, not English literature.
So speaking of English compositions, you actually have to compose three pieces, is it a month, for your various outlets, and talk a little bit about them.
Well, it's certainly three essays, three brief essays. I do a column for Today.com, which is Today's show's web presence. Mm-hmm. I do a column for EatingWell.com, and I do a column for Southern Living. And so I talk about food. I talk about different aspects of food in each one. And yes, I have to do three essays a month.
That's a lot. And tell us about the book.
The book that I'm working on.
Yeah.
Well, I don't, you know, I'm sort of superstitious. I really don't like to say too much about things until they're happened.
Got it. So you don't even want to give us the title?
The working title is Braided Heritage, and beyond that, I'm not sure. I think it may be Braided Heritage, an American cookbook. We'll see. But I want to be sure that what I say is what it is, so I think I might be better off just writing it before I talk too much.
That's fair. And have you started to meet with the folks about the second season of High on the Hog or not yet?
Not yet. I haven't, which doesn't mean that they haven't. I haven't.
I hope we get some more of your on-screen presence.
We'll see. We'll see.
Oh, come on. You're really good at that. Well, this has been great, Jessica Harris, and it is thrilling for the rest of us, even though you're just putting your head down and doing what you've always done, to see how many lives you've changed, both in the classroom and in the printed word and now on TV. So it's kind of cool.
Who knew? That's pretty much where I am with it all. It's like, okay, I'm just going to keep my head down, not take too much of this moment in, because you don't want to get, you know, all puffed up like a bullfrog, and then just move forward and hopefully keep working.
Yeah, well, Jessica Harris, you are one of our national treasures.
Yeah.
No, I know you don't like to hear that kind of
God,
stuff.
God, no.
Anyway, it's great to talk to you again, and we look forward to the book and the next season of High on the Hog and your columns, and just keep on keeping on, Jessica.
I'm going to try to do that for as long as I can. You take care, Ed.
Last February on Special Sauce, we talked to celebrity chef Marcus Samuelson about Jessica. I asked him to talk about Harris's specific contributions to the food culture in general.
It starts with her deep knowledge and love for writing, but also for Black culture, right? Being that bridge. And I think that it has to do with the civil rights movement and coming out of that, right? As a young writer, how can I add value? Right? There's an incredible gap between how people relate to food from the continent of Africa, how it has impacted American food, right? And Jessica has really devoted her life to narrow that gap and talk about the individuals that was part of that, you know, going back to Edna Lewis, but also everyone was not famous. A lot of the people that Ms. Jessica Harris talks about, she's a champion of the people just doing the work.
Mm-hmm.
And majority of them are anonymously, but they're in her books, they're in her speeches, and she points us to the link that Caribbean contribution to American food, African contribution to American food, Bahia in Brazil, for example. She talks about geographically the way other writers talk about regions like Tuscany or Provence, right? Which are now something that American diners and readers understand. Well, guess what? So much of America's food has to do with how it came from Africa. And Jessica's helped us unpack that. I wouldn't have written The Rise. I definitely wouldn't have written The Soul of a New Cuisine without Jessica Harris' work. I probably would never even have opened Red Rooster without it, because there was no one there before to point me towards that direction. So I had to study a lot of Jessica's work. You know, I've had so many great memories. I remember we both loved Cafe Beulah in the 90s, this incredible restaurant on Park Avenue.
Right, Alexander Small's restaurant.
We were both fans of that. I came up in the late 90s and studied a lot of these great African-American restaurants like Cafe Beulah, like Jezebel's. And then I took notes and asked to speak to someone like Miss Jessica Harris to explain it to me. What was there before? How did they get to this journey? And all of that information helped me write The Soul of a New Cuisine that came out in 2006 or 7. And then Open Red Rooster, 2010. And then eventually do the Red Rooster Cookbook and The Rise, you know, which those books. And it's completely changed and transformed my life, how I cook and how I broadcast.
That's pretty amazing. I guess what you're saying is that she really was a trailblazer and she helped you connect the dots.
Absolutely. She is a trailblazer. She keeps on writing. People keep finding her and finding new mediums to broadcast her work. And it's just fantastic that we finally celebrate her for all the work that she's done. And she deserves this because this is a lifetime achievement, what she's done. There are 5 original cuisines in America that all stemmed to Black culture. If you go through her books, they're right there, whether it's Low Country, Southern Food, Cajun, Creole, and Barbecue. These are all topics that Miss Jessica Harris has written about and help us understand from a very important perspective. I just think that food media needs to be diversified, and it's happening now. You know, diversity is key, right? And it's happening in this country now, but we know in all platforms of media, we're not diverse enough, and in food as well, right? So it's important, this moment that we're going through right now, but it's a lot of catching up, you know, and institutions that are missing Jessica's work, that's not Jessica's fault, that's on them. She kept doing her books and they're incredible. And I urge people to go to them because there's something for all of us to learn. Great jewels and pearls are being misunderstood and not broadcasted the right way. That's not on the individual. That is in the larger conversation where we are in American history. The good thing is now that because of internet and because of social media, there are less gatekeepers and people can broadcast in a completely different way.
Last February on Special Sauce, we did a deep dive into Jessica's remarkable life and work before High on the Hog became a Netflix series. You started writing when you started writing about theater and culture for many Black publications like the Amsterdam News and Essence. How did that come about?
Oh, goodness. Well, I graduated from college in 1968, the great 68, yay us, which was a pivotal year in the world, not just in the United States. And 68 to 69, I was doing my licence in France. 69 to 70, I lived with my parents. And then in 70, moved to the West Village and, you know, sort of hooked up again with some friends that I had been in high school with, sort of lost touch with over college, but had been in high school with them, and they were at that point in time working on a TV show called Soul.
Which is fascinating, you know, and now a lot of people have started writing about Soul because it was so ahead of its time and profoundly influential in all the artists they presented.
Well, I mean, there's not been anything like it since. Soul with Ellis Hazlip was an extraordinary show. It was an absolutely extraordinary show where you could turn in one week and see the mother of the Soledad brothers, and turn in the next week and see
Gladys Knight and the Pips.
Gladys Knight and the Pips, or the right Reverend Al Green in his rose throwing stage, or you could see poets, Sonia Sanchez, or you could see Nikki Giovanni interviewing James Baldwin. It was just an extraordinary range.
You didn't work there, but you had a lot of friends who did.
I had friends who did. Anna Maria Horsford, who people may remember from TV shows like Amen, worked there, and she and I had been in college together. Loretta Green, who I think goes by the acting name of Retta Green, worked there. And I spent an awful lot of time sitting on a chair there watching them
just hanging.
Do their thing, just hanging. But it was also the time of the Black Arts Movement in New York City, so there was an extraordinary just sort of bubbling up of all kinds of things, from theater, like the Negro Ensemble Company and things like that, all the way through to soul, which was its own extraordinary thing. And people were around and doing things.
So you started writing about theater and travel, like for the Amsterdam News and lots of magazine stories. In your memoir, you talked about they were almost all for Black publications. Were non-Black publications off limits for most Black writers at the time?
I honestly don't know, because it never occurred to me one way or the other. I started out writing for basically one of those sort of things that happens, you know, you get them, pick them up for free if you want them at the supermarket, basically to see if there are any apartments or if there's any stuff for free that you'd like. And I wrote for that, and then I took that body of work, which is really dignifying it, probably way more than it needs to be, and went to Encore magazine, which was a news publication, and I wrote for them, started doing book reviews for them, and then ended up at Essence, but simultaneously, somehow or other, ended up writing theater reviews for the Amsterdam News. And it was at the Amsterdam News that I was told, and I've never really investigated it, but I suspect it's true because nobody's called me a liar, that I was the first African-American woman to vote for the Tonys. So that it was quite an experience. You know, I didn't get first night theater tickets, but I got second night theater tickets for just an extraordinary range of plays, because that was also happening back then. Mm-hmm. There was The Wiz, there was Bubbling Brown Sugar, there were all sorts of plays that were coming into being and heading to Broadway and off-Broadway.
You alluded earlier to living in the village surrounded by people you knew, and it was sort of the center of Black intellectual life in New York at the time, right?
Well, it was and it wasn't. I think there were two poles. I think there was the West Village, which certainly was what the West Village was, but then there was also the Upper West Side. And the Upper West Side was not what it is today. It was grittier. It was, you know, transforming, slowly gentrifying in another kind of way, but it was also the epicenter, or another epicenter of, or I guess you can only have one epicenter, but it was another center of a lot of Black culture, so that the Upper West Side had places like Two Steps Down. There were restaurants. There was the Club Michael's, which was an extraordinary place where I believe, if I'm not mistaken, Whitney Houston had her debut at Michael's when her mother, Sissy, couldn't go on, and she sort of pushed Whitney out and said, "You go sing."
I was in that world. I ran a club downtown, but I lived in Park West Village when I graduated in 1973, and I found out in your book that I was surrounded by luminaries I didn't even know that were living in Park West Village.
See, you should have gotten out more.
So, yeah, tell us about some of the people that you got to know who lived in Park West Village.
Well, I think Maya Angelou lived in Park West Village for a while. I know Rosa Gee lived in Park West Village. Louise Merriweather lived and still lives in Park West Village. So that there are an awful lot of not only luminaries, but just amazing human beings.
Yeah.
From that period who lived there, so that there was just an incredible kind of coming together of things.
And what was it like to be in the center of that world, right, as a young woman?
Well, I don't know that I was in the center of it. People often ask, what was it like? It's like, it was normal to me because it was the only thing I knew. So, and it's still the only thing I know. I don't know what it was like to be somewhere else. I mean, it might have been, in retrospect, it might have been more interesting to be in Brooklyn or, I don't know, somewhere else. I doubt it. It was certainly being at a particular moment in time that was clearly and palpably a special moment in time. But I can't put it in any kind of context because it's the only thing I knew.
Were you intimidated to be in the presence of Maya Angelou and Toni Morrison and James Baldwin?
Yeah. In a word, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I'm not stupid. I kind of knew who they were. It was rarefied air. I mean, it was rarefied air that I was privileged to be able to breathe on the periphery, but it was extraordinary. It was absolutely extraordinary. And I think that in their own way, they knew how extraordinary it was. I mean, I am 20 years younger than Maya. I don't remember where Jimmy falls in that, but I was the kid.
Mm-hmm.
I was the kid, and they had not become the oh-my-God genuflect icons that they subsequently became, but they were certainly notable people. They were notable people, but they could still go out in public without getting mobbed in many ways. I think it was probably less true of Jimmy, but Maya, and just the fact that I call her in my head Maya, as opposed to Dr. Angelou, speaks to that time.
You wrote in your memoir that she actually wanted to be called Dr. Angelou by people who didn't know her well.
Well, absolutely, because it was an honorific. It is an honorific, and it's an honorific that she had bestowed upon her multiple times over. I mean, she was Dr. Angelou. You know, I mean, it's her due.
Yeah.
So I certainly would accord it to her. There's no question.
When I reread your memoir, which is called My Soul Looks Back, which is an awesome book, by the way, I realized in retrospect, it's your story about your relationship with Maya and your relationship with Sam, your longtime lover. And those relationships sort of frame the narrative of the book.
Oh, absolutely. I knew Maya for more than 40 years.
Wow.
So that's a long time, and it's a long trajectory. It took me from 20 to 60.
Wow.
And it took her from 40 to 80. So that's a long time, and people mature and change, and relationships morph and evolve and expand and contract. And there was a period of at least a decade, possibly longer, where we weren't in touch. But when I came back into the fold, as it were, you know, it's nice and it's rare. And as one ages, it's lovely to know people with whom you share past.
It's true. It's true. What's interesting to me is that I first got to know you and know of you as a food writer. But we haven't talked about food writing. How did you come to start writing about food?
Well, I started in through book reviews and theater reviews and actually feature articles. I did one of the earliest interviews of Toni Morrison, and I did an interview of the ladies who were in the play For Colored Girls, which was, you know, one of those sort of seminal, pivotal moments in theater for African-American women. I am losing track of when folks leave us, which isn't good. I mean, I'm still having a hard time dealing with the fact that I'm living in a world with no Aretha.
Yeah.
Just the fact that those creators are not with us mm-hmm. anymore is something that changes the nature of the world. It changes the nature of creativity, and it changes how things go. So a world without Aretha is a very different world.
Yeah, for sure.
A world without Toni Morrison is a different world, you know. So it's looking back at that point in time when we both were young and full of vitality and peppy. It's kind of extraordinary.
Yeah.
But so how did I get into food, which was your question that got me on that long, circuitous route? I went to Essence Magazine. I started out as the book review editor there. And gradually they discovered, oh, she's somebody who travels, because as a result of being a French major and having lived in France, I used to go to France twice a year. And so they were like, write something for us. So I wrote something and they liked it. And the next thing I knew, I was the assistant or associate travel editor. And then gradually I became, actually, another irony. They had a male travel editor at Essence, and I became the first black woman travel editor of the Black Woman's Magazine. So that was kind of fun, because that sort of allowed me to spread my wings. And then from that, I started writing about travel and food, and from that, got into food.
Got it. You've written 12 cookbooks.
Yeah. Fools rush in.
And the first one was 1989?
earlier than that. I think it might have been 87 or 86 even. But yeah, it was called Hot Stuff, and it was about food made with peppers and chilies from around the world.
What's interesting to me as someone who's been in the food media culture for so long is that you were perhaps one of the first or the first writers to write about food of the African diaspora. How did you arrive at that? How did you try to connect the dots in that special way?
First of all, there was a woman named Helen Mendez, who probably is the first person to do this. But I wasn't aware of her when I started. And what happened was I was listening to my mouth because I was getting it from the travel rather than getting it from research or an intellectual position or anything like that. My first trip to Western Africa was, and I make that distinction because I had gone to Morocco several times before I went to Senegal. And when I went to Senegal, it was 1972, I believe. And that is, as I like to say, BR, before Roots. Alex Haley's book, Roots, changed a lot of people's perceptions of Africa. At the time that Roots occurred, or shortly thereafter, there was a travel company called International Weekends that used to do back-to-back charter trips to Senegal for a really unbelievably small amount of money. I mean, it was like $500. You could go round trip. Now, you go round trip, it included the hotel, but the hotel was out by the airport, which was darn near a $50 cab ride into town, and there was no public transportation. Everybody was delighted to be where they were, but getting into Dakar and all of that was something different. But that's a digression. I actually went to Senegal before Roots and before International Weekend and before all of that happened. And that was a different time in Western Africa because there were very few Black American tourists, very few American tourists, period. Particularly very few American tourists who spoke fluent French in the French-speaking places in Africa. You know, I made friends. I made some friends there that are still friends. My mother went with me, my super taster, went with me on my first trip there, and it was wonderful because she would eat everything. I sometimes got a little picky, but I remember I was in Abidjan, in Côte d'Ivoire, on the Ivory Coast, and they served a sauce claire, which is a broth made, you know, with fish stock. I have shellfish allergies, and so my mother was like, I'll eat this one. I'll take this one for the team. And there was a lone fish eye floating in it, and my mother sort of looked down, sort of looked at it, looked at me, put it in her spoon, and whoop, took care of it. So
wow.
It was, yeah. No, my mother was pretty special on things like that. We used to always joke about the fish eye.
She's more than a super taster. She's a profile in courage.
Well, that for sure. Yeah, yeah.
And did you immediately connect the food in Senegal to the food that you'd had growing up and the food that you'd eaten in the States?
Not always, but there were dishes that had familiar flavors. I contend that there are two basic flavor patterns, people who like creamy things and people who like things that are more acidulated. I am an acidulated person. I don't necessarily need creamy and that, you know, sort of unctuousness. So that the thing that was interesting was when I first tasted chicken yassa or ganar yassa, yassa ganar, which is a Senegalese traditional chicken dish. And Senegal is one of those places in Western Africa that has rice, that grows rice. And so they eat rice. The Peace Corps folks who went to Senegal used to joke that the Lord's Prayer should be changed to give us this day our daily rice, because every day there is rice in some form at the table.
Got it.
So the chicken yassa encompassed all of those things that subsequently were spoken about by chefs. You know, you talk about layering flavors and things, and it was done traditionally. It is chicken that is marinated. It is marinated with lemon juice, lime juice, and onions, sliced onions, and so that's your basic marinade, little peanut oil usually. Then it is grilled, next level of layering on things, so it is grilled over wood flame.
I need some of this right now.
Uh-huh, and you don't even know where it's going. And then on top of that, they stew it. So it gets stewed with the marinade. So you've got the marinade that's tenderizing the chicken. You've got the slightly smoky undertaste. You've got then the stewing that allows it all to sort of transform, and it's served over white rice. First time I tasted that, that was like, whoa, okay, this is good stuff, you know, because up until that point, I don't think people in the States, certainly I didn't know very much about the food of Africa and thought it was all, you know, hot and, you know, something that was going to be very peppery and, you know, sort of chili infused. And I don't even know what I was expecting. But there was a subtlety to it and there was a familiarity to it. I've never had anything like that, but I'd had grilled chicken certainly before. And I'd had certainly onions. I am an onion fanatic. I love them.
Stewed chicken you'd had, obviously.
And I'd certainly had white rice. So all of those things together were something that made it work.
And that's where you started to make the connections.
That was part of the beginning of the connections. And then the Bryn Mawr, if you will, kicked in. Then it's like, oh, well, I need to research this because I really need to know why this has happened and what are we talking about here and what's going on. And then all of those questions started to come up. And the more I traveled, the more things I tasted, and so on and so forth.
Was it scary to investigate something that not a lot of people had done, or are you more excited than anything else?
I don't even know that I was aware that folks hadn't done it. It was one of those fool's rush in moments. It's like, I want to know, and there's stuff that I can read. I wasn't trying to find a tome that, you know, sort of said, okay, it's this, and then it's that, and then it's that. It was like, well, let me think about this, and let's look. So it all came in sequence, I guess, in different time building blocks kind of thing.
So of the 12 cookbooks, some are still available, probably some are out of print. What should Special Sauce listeners turn to first?
I will never tell.
Even though it's not really a cookbook, I loved High on the Hog so much because it was so personal. It was sort of, in many ways, a spiritual adventure for you.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, High on the Hog is kind of a culmination. It's sort of an ending and a beginning in the sense that it is not a cookbook.
Yeah.
It is a narrative history of African Americans and food from its African inception to, well, what was then present day. But I mean, because it is so wide in scope, it is something that then has to be done differently. So each chapter, for those who had Latin at any point, all Gaul was divided into three parts. And in High on the Hog, all chapters are, like Gaul, divided into three parts. So the first part is a kind of personal narrative, what the French would call a mise en scène, a setting of the scene. It usually is a geographic location that has some bearing to the chapter that will follow. Then the chapter itself, the meat of the chapter, if you will, is the historic telling of the tale, or telling and advancing of the tale. And then the end of the chapter is kind of a coda, a little, you know, what they would call in Louisiana or in New Orleans, a lagniappe, a little something extra.
So there were stories with recipes.
Pretty much. Yeah. Pretty much.
That's it for this edition of Special Sauce. We want to thank Jessica Harris for bringing us up to speed on her many ongoing projects, including the not-yet-shot season 2 of High on the Hog. We'll be back in 2 weeks with another brand new episode of Special Sauce. Please stay safe and healthy, serious eaters, and continue to do whatever you can during the pandemic to support your local restaurants and the purveyors that supply them. If you've enjoyed listening to Jessica Harris, Marcus Samuelson, and me, and want more Special Sauce in your life, just subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Here's the best part. It's free. To help spread the word, you can even review Special Sauce on either Apple Podcasts or Podchaser. So long, Serious Eaters. See you next time.
Special Sauce is produced by John Kalish and Ed Levine. Our theme music was composed by Charlie Morrow for Morrow Sound.